The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Protests that erupted after the release of video and the police shooting death of Chicago teenager Laquan McDonald. The protesters demanded the resignation of top officials, including Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who eventually fired top police official Gary McCarthy. On Thursday, three candidates were named as finalists to take over as superintendent of the Chicago Police Department. It is one of the hardest jobs in the country. Gun violence still takes a huge toll in the city. The department reported 43 deaths in the city of Chicago in February. And earlier this month, 21 people were shot in less than a day, about 1 hour. How tough is this police superintendent job, and will Chicago get what it needs to move forward? Two people now with big stakes in the process and the future. Deborah Shelton is managing editor at the Chicago Reporter, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on race, poverty, and income inequality. And Lori Lightfoot is a partner at the law firm of Mayor Brown and president of the Chicago Police Board, who led the search for the new police superintendent.
Well, it's certainly an important milestone. The department needs permanent leadership. It needs somebody who will address many of the concerns internally and externally. But clearly there are bigger issues and bigger forces at work. And while I think the next leader will play a very specific and prominent role in the narrative that's playing out here in Chicago, all of us here need to roll up our sleeves and address some of these larger systemic issues that go way beyond local law enforcement.
Deborah Shelton, is the new superintendent more important than the mayor at this particular moment in Chicago's history?
The new superintendent is one part of a much bigger system, as Lori just mentioned. One of the questions, and one thing that comes that's very positive that comes out of what's been going on here in Chicago over the last several months, is that people are asking really important questions that haven't really been discussed here. And one issue with the new police superintendent, although conversation has centered since yesterday when the finalists were announced on race, the possibility of the first female police chief, whether it should be an insider or an outsider who takes over, there really are some more meaningful questions that need to be asked about the role of the police chief in putting meaningful structural reforms in place. And there are a lot of questions about the ability of the police chief to do that in light of, for example, the contract between the city and the police union, which really, in many ways, makes it very difficult to put these kinds of structural reforms in place.
Would you say that the engagement of citizens in Chicago, which is really through the roof in all of the controversy that's happened over the last 2 years, has been a help in picking a new superintendent, has created a situation perhaps where someone's going to be disappointed and they're used to speaking loud about their dissatisfaction? What do you think, Lori?
Well, clearly the voices of the community who have risen up, particularly starting last summer and over the course of the fall, played an integral role in our thinking about the kind of issues and priorities that the next superintendent should have, the characteristics that that person should have. It's reflected in the application that we put out, which had 8 specific essay questions that we called upon all applicants to answer and address in depth. It certainly played a role in thinking about questions for the interviewees and the way in which we approach the very probing questions that we ask every single person that we brought in. We have neighborhoods that are incredibly impoverished and have been for decades. We have a lack of investment, a lack of community anchors. And those are bigger questions that can't be solved by law enforcement alone. There's got to be a lot of resources that are brought to bear, both from city government and private partnerships.
So among the candidates, 2 African-American men, 1 white woman. Only one of them is from Chicago. Who wants this job?
Well, a lot of people wanted this job. We had 39 people that applied from all over the country with a variety of impressive backgrounds. You know, let's not lose sight of the fact that this is the second largest police department in the country. It has a tremendous number of assets, not just the people, and the people are good and strong as well, but a lot of other innovative policies and procedures. They have clearly fallen short in a number of profound ways. They've fallen short in the manner in which they engage the public, but this is still very much an important local law enforcement position across the country. It's the second largest police force in the country, and I think people still regard it as such, despite the fact that there are a lot of challenges and a lot of uncertainties. If you are the person who becomes the police chief of Chicago, you have the potential to have a platform where you have a national voice and you can do some very transformative places, transformative things in this city. So if you are up to that challenge and you've got the bandwidth and the gravitas to do the job, there's no better place than Chicago.
Can the police veto any selection by just being resistant, by just basically saying, we don't like anybody here?
Well, you certainly worry about the notion of malicious compliance, which is what I think you're getting at. But fundamentally, the men and women of most of the men and women of the Chicago Police Department went into and do their job every day for the right reasons. They want to be public servants. They want to truly serve and protect. They just need the leadership to do that.
Two questions before we go. First one for you, Lori. Is there a community favorite or a Chicago Police Board favorite here that you can talk about?
Well, we have the luxury of simply recommending three finalists, and it's not for us to pick which of the three would be better. I think that it's important for the community to have information about them. That's why we put out their full resumes. We put out the full answers to the essay questions that tackled a range of issues that I think are top of mind and important for the community. And at the end of the day, it's up to the mayor. The mayor, the public is going to hold the mayor accountable for what happens on the policing scene here in Chicago. And the mayor has to take his measure of each of these three people. I'm sure he has a vision of what he wants and he thinks the priority should be. And he's going to assess that and see whether or not and how these three individuals measure up. And we all anxiously await his decision.
Finally, Deborah, the criteria you're describing of someone who really needs to address the community honestly. And I've lived in Chicago, and this is such a staggeringly complex issue. And if you bring in the social issues of race, poverty, and income inequality that you described earlier, I mean, it's just, you know, very, very difficult to get a handle on. Nevertheless, at the risk of trivializing, it seems to me that this is not unlike the job that Chris Rock had at the Academy Awards, in the sense that there is a lot of misunderstanding, there is a lot of angst, and here was somebody who came into a job and maybe didn't want it, but in some way, it seems to me, and there are probably people who would criticize me, developed a kind of intelligent narrative to speak to everybody. And, you know, we don't want a comedian here, but boy, that's what's required. Something like that. And I wonder if you think there's somebody up to the task, even if you disagree with my model here.
I think that depending on who you talk to, there are different expectations of this police chief. I think, unlike the past, when many people expected the police chief to be a miracle worker, I think there are some expectations that there are limits in the job and what that person can do. I actually spoke to an activist leader yesterday and asked his opinion about the three finalists, and his view was it's like changing chairs on the Titanic. He wasn't concerned so much who the individual is, whether it's a woman or man, whether it's black, white, or Hispanic, whether that person is an insider or outsider. But the concern is, will this person have an attitude and mindset of reform, use whatever powers they have at their disposal to try to put those reforms in place, and then work with all the other stakeholders here, whether it's the Cook County State's Attorney, whether it's community groups, to get everybody engaged in making those structural reforms. So I guess, you know, from the people that I've interviewed and talked to, it's less of an issue of who that individual is. You know, undoubtedly the three finalists have the qualifications. They meet, you know, the standards that you would expect for police chief. It's just a matter of what powers do they really have in the real world.
leading with the language of trust and finding a way to speak to everyone in the community. Is that partly the key, Deborah?
Yeah, I think, you know, being willing to be open. I mean, the last the police chief was criticized for, you know, being arrogant and for not really respecting the community. And so I think people expect that there is going to be that respect and openness there. That's what they're looking for.
All right. Well, Lori Lightfoot and Deborah Shelton, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Lori Lightfoot is a partner at the law firm of Mayor Brown and president of the Chicago Police Board, who led the search for the new police superintendent. Deborah Shelton is managing editor at the Chicago Reporter, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on race, poverty, and income inequality.
Lula, deixa eu te falar uma coisa. Seguinte, eu tô mandando o Bessia junto com o papel.
It's the phone call heard round the world. An alleged government deal to protect a former head of state from corruption charges has plunged Brazil into chaos once again.
Tá?
Tá bom, tá bom.
Só isso. Você espera aí que ele tá indo aí.
Tá bom.
That recording made public brought thousands of protesters into the streets of Brazil, condemning President Dilma Rousseff's sudden appointment of her predecessor, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, into her cabinet. The political deal would have rendered him immune from corruption charges. At the center of all of this is the Brazilian oil giant Petrobras. Rousseff was chairwoman of the Petrobras board when the wrongdoing occurred. She has denied knowledge of it, but momentum for her impeachment is growing. Bruce Douglas, Brazil correspondent for Latin American Newsletters, is in Brasilia and says the population is clearly fed up with the government altogether.
Well, there's huge degrees of insatisfaction in Brazilian society in general. You have to bear in mind the economy has shrunk by almost 4% last year. There are a lot of people really feeling the pain. Inflation is over 10%. Over a million people lost their jobs last year. So the situation in terms of Brazilians' day-to-day experiences is pretty bleak for many. And on top of that, you have this massive, now a two-year-long investigation into corruption at Petrobras, the state-run oil company, which is not just any old company, but which was once the largest company in Latin America and also a major source of pride for Brazilians. It was, in theory, the guarantor of their economic independence. It was founded with the slogan, "The oil is ours," and it's a key driver of the Brazilian economy, and it has been involved in this corruption scandal, which has implicated many of the country's top business executives, these business leaders from Brazil's major construction companies, as well as almost 50 serving politicians. And over the last few weeks, we've seen this inquiry get closer and closer to former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and his hand-picked successor, Dilma Rousseff. And these protests are an expression of an outrage at the corruption and extreme frustration with the economic deterioration of the country.
And here's a voice of the raging protests that you describe, really taking the get-out-of-jail-free card interpretation here. João Matus is a law student. Listen.
I'm here because the ruling party, the party that is in government right now, is a criminal organization that is ripping our pockets. They tax us in a very high amount of taxes, and they don't give us anything in return. And they are communists, and they want to overtake Brazil. They will do anything to stay in power.
Now, he's a 22-year-old. Listen to this 54-year-old woman, Ortelia Mendes.
We wanted to get these corrupt people out of power. We voted for them thinking there would be change, and nothing happened. I voted for Lula in 2003, and now I see the country is worse than it was before.
Realistically speaking, do the people have any mechanism to change things? Is the deck so stacked from the top?
What's happening now is an impeachment process, which is going through Congress. Last night, Congress voted the members of a committee which will analyze the case for impeachment. Actually, the impeachment against Dilma Rousseff is based on what many interpret as a technicality. She's accused of illegally using state banks to plug gaps in the budget in 2014. Now, really, the substance of the impeachment question isn't the issue. It becomes less of a legal case than a political case. And the question is whether the president has the support in Congress to survive.
And the Olympics?
It's difficult to know what's going to happen in Brazil in the next few hours, let alone days, weeks and months. It's been an extraordinary week of political drama here, and this is likely to continue, certainly for the foreseeable. There are pro-government rallies planned in 45 cities across Brazil today. They're likely to be the target of the anti-government protesters' ire. And so what happens with the Olympics? It takes place in Rio. The Rio municipal and state government are doing everything they possibly can to ensure that it is delivered on time and with the usual success that marks these events. It may be impossible to divide Brazil's political situation from this event. However, as I said, Brazil is very concerned about its international image, and they will be making the utmost efforts to ensure that the Olympic Games run smoothly, even if the country itself is in chaos.
Speaking to us from Brasilia, Bruce Douglas is Brazil correspondent for Latin American Newsletters. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
The urgent policy demands to halt the advance of climate change are the focus of heads of state, experts, scientists, academics, engineers, on-the-ground activists. But the urgency and terrible reality of the Earth's changes can also be found in the heart of one young woman. One woman of the 13 million Americans directly threatened by sea level rise, millions more in communities all over the world. A study published earlier this week in Nature Climate Change puts the date at 2100, when the waters will overwhelm coastal cities on every continent. But for 18-year-old Selena Lem, from the island of Majuro, the capital and largest city in the Marshall Islands, 2100 is today. Selena is experiencing a loss that much of the rest of the world may have marked on the calendar, but her greatest fear since she was a little girl has come to pass.
It would be my island's drowning, because I live right next to the water, and so seeing the water rise and then it's just my island's just disappearing.
When there's weather, when there are storms, what happens?
When the storms are happening, we usually receive notification from through our radio that there's going to be an inundation soon. And so a lot of people, either they sleep in a hotel or somewhere where it's quite farther away from the water, or they just stay in their house and just get prepared for the waves. And then they just crash into these seawalls and they break them, and then just they destroy the soil and all the crops that we have, and then a lot of the homes that are along the way.
So when you were a little girl, you could imagine sitting and watching a storm without worrying about your home being torn away from its moorings. But now you can't even do that.
Well, I grew up with these inundations because we receive them every year. But the problem is currently they've just been happening during seasons that they're not supposed to happen. And so when the waves come, they're usually way over the seawalls that a lot of people have built across the seashore. And so as it is becoming more frequent, there's this increasing worry amongst a lot of us that our islands are just going to disappear.
Have you always been afraid of the water when you were growing up?
It wasn't really that immense scared that I started feeling nowadays. Because there was this one time I cannot really remember. I think it was 3 years ago or 4 years ago. And I was in my room, and I had, usually when the waves would come, I would close my curtains. Because in our culture, it is believed that whenever a wave comes, women are not allowed to see it. Women are not allowed to look at the water because it is believed that the ghost who lives in the water is actually mad. And so if she knows that we're looking at her, she will get even more angrier. And so I would always close the curtains. But this one time, I forgot to close it. And so I went into my room, and I saw the waves going above the seawall that my uncles and my grandfather had built. And then they just went over the seawall and just crashed into my grandparents' grave. Seeing that was like the first time where I felt the wave kind of insulted me or really demeaned me by just washing over my grandparents' graves and just bringing all the rubbish that the ocean has. And just seeing that was very, it is quite upsetting.
And it's not caused by anything you did. It's the result of decisions that people have made about energy and consumption and pollution thousands and thousands of miles away from you.
Yes. And that is what makes this thing even harder, because then we're just a small island and you question yourself, like, what would a big country like that care about a small country with only 72,000 people?
Are all of the people of the island and islands thinking about just heading somewhere else?
There hasn't really been plan on moving out. At least that's what I've known so far. But a lot of people have already started moving out. Some have lost their homes because due to the waves. But as for myself, I haven't really thought of that. I've just thought of just finishing my education and going back home and work there.
Selena, what would you want to ask someone who's ahead of you, who's actually moved because of the effects of climate change? And there are thousands of people around the world who have had to move already. What would you ask them? What do you want to know from their experience?
Is it hard? I'm sure you've had close friends or relatives or your grandparents or your parents' graves already in those small islands. And now that you're going to move away, how does it feel leaving all that behind?
What do you most want to hear from them?
I guess some optimism.
What would you take with you? What would you leave behind?
I would leave memories. My grandparents, the woman I grew up with, my culture, my home.
And what do you pack with you?
Memories in my head, seashells, handicrafts.
Photos.
Yes, photos from that my grandpa really made sure to save. It'd be very nice to look at them so many years from now on.
I hope we haven't upset you.
No, it's okay. It's just hard to think about these things.
Selena Lam losing her home in the Marshall Islands and the places where her elders are buried. She's both a potential climate refugee and a climate activist. Today's coverage of climate change is a collaboration with WBEZ's Heat of the Moment project. You can find more at heatofthemoment.org. In this St. Patrick's Day week, there is some deep history and remembrance among the Irish all over the world. This is the 100th anniversary of the Easter Rising Revolution in Ireland. On Easter Monday in 1916, as Europe was deep in the violence of World War I, more than 1,600 rebels in Ireland rose up against British rule. At first, the Rising had limited backing from the Irish public. It was Irish Americans who supported the cause and grasped its significance. One of the events marking the centenary is happening right here in Boston. Father Oliver Rafferty helped organize it. He's a professor of history and director of the Irish Studies program at Boston College, and he joins me now right here in the studios of WGBH in Boston. Father Rafferty, welcome.
Thank you.
So what are the remembrances here in the United States, in Dublin? I suspect in Belfast there's a different sort of memory, and all over the world.
Part of the difficulty, and the reason why some people are kind of hesitant about the whole idea of remembering the Rising, is the fact that throughout the rest of the 20th century, one has people who were involved in, for example, terrorist activities, the Irish Republican Army in particular, claiming the justification for terrorist activity is predicated on the legacy of the 1916 Rising. And as we all know, in more recent years, up until 1998, we had a 30-year terrorist campaign in Ireland, not entirely orchestrated by the IRA, but they played an enormous kind of part in that terrible period of death and destruction. And they explicitly appealed to what had happened in 1916. It is true that the Irish government has an enormous program of commemoration of the Rising. But to some extent, and this is my own perhaps idiosyncratic view, to some extent it was forced into that, because it was clear that Sinn Féin, the sort of political wing of the IRA, that they were going to dominate celebrations, commemorations about 1916. So the Irish government had to act to try to ensure that the legacy of 1916 was not used for glorification, shall we say, of violence by people who have only in recent times repudiated violence.
It's been a tough many years for Ireland financially. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if this centenary is a moment of relief, even given the ambiguity, and the celebrations that you're going to be involved in will shed some of the confusion that has dominated the historical legacy of this event down through the years. Mm.
So part of the celebration, commemoration, is to try to kind of buy into that, to recapture, to reinvigorate, shall we say, a sense of Irish nationalism, a sense of equality, a sense of where we're going as a nation. What does it mean to be an Irish nation playing its part in the world today? And therefore, it's kind of to look back to see that there was a vision, shall we say, at the beginning of the 20th century, not just a kind of a vision about separatism from Britain, but also a vision about Irish culture. Because after all, the Rising is drawing on a movement that had begun in the 1890s, the Irish Revival, the Gaelic Revival, trying to kind of reconnect a sense of nationhood with the Irish people, and a revival of things like the Irish theatre, Yeats and Lady Gregory, the Gaelic language with kind of Douglas Hyde and Owen McNeill. In other words, to give a certain sense to people in Ireland that we are a nation with an ancient heritage. And if we are to play a part in the modern world, that's what we have to buy into.
Is this a 4th of July moment for the Irish, or is it maybe a little more complex than that, even though I suspect there is going to be some raising of glasses, there is going to be some reading of great literature and poetry and all of that here in Boston and in Dublin and around.
It is interesting, isn't it, that Americans, by and large, when they celebrate the 4th of July, don't have these ambiguities about that event, about the, as it were, the attempt by Americans to separate themselves from Britain, despite the fact, obviously, it was a war, it was a revolution. For the Irish, particularly given the kind of the history of violence in 20th century Ireland, that forms part and parcel of how we look back at the Rising, and therefore the great ambiguities surrounding that event and its legacy for Irish history. So in other words, the issue is this. Is Irish nationalism, is Irish sense of identity predicated on violence? Or is it predicated on something else, an idealism that is written into the proclamation of the Irish Republic in 1916?
I suspect you would say the latter. Mm. And what's the Gaelic honorific or celebratory language that you would use on the centenary?
Well, strangely enough, of course, the problem now in Ireland is that the Gaelic language, the Irish language, has fallen out of use as the medium of kind of everyday speech. And this is something that certainly Patrick Pearse would have, had he have lived, would have had deeply regretted. Why? Because he famously says on one occasion, it's not just a question of Ireland being free, but it is a question of Ireland being Gaelic, Gaelic and free. And therefore the kind of the foundation motif, if you like, of this new nation, of this new vision of life, had to be both free and Irish.
So what's your call for this centenary? Is it a prayer? Is it a poem? Is it a reference? Is it some language that's particularly important to you as you think back and join with so many people here in Boston?
My own hopes are this, that in looking back to the past, we would have a sense of how Ireland and Irish people are to play their role in contemporary society. What can we learn from a violent past? What can we learn from the conflict in Ireland, which has lasted, of course, a very long time, that will enable us to look anew at ourselves and share that with other situations of conflict and of violence? That's certainly my hope of what will emerge as a result of thinking about the events of 100 years ago.
He'll be celebrating and remembering. Father Oliver Rafferty is Professor of History and Director of the Irish Studies Program at Boston College. Thanks so much, Father.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. March Madness is here, which leads to April Champions and the Final Four. The NCAA tournament began yesterday. 12th-seeded Yale stunned 5-seed Baylor. 11th-seed Gonzaga advanced over 6-seed Seton Hall. UConn pulled off an upset, as did Little Rock and Wichita State. 1-seed Kansas, though, obliterated its 16th-seed opponent. North Carolina and Virginia, two other top seeds, also had no trouble. These college players throughout the tournament are some of the finest young athletes across America, and more than 75% of men's Division I basketball players think they will play professionally. Even my high school son thinks he's going to play professionally. How many make it to the NBA? Less than 2%. David Gardner, college basketball producer with Sports Illustrated. Hope springs eternal. David, what's wrong with that?
Nothing. March Madness is the best postseason in American sports because everybody comes in with the belief that they can win it all. And they've seen teams like those Cinderella stories you're talking about get to the Final Four on many occasions before.
Now, I imagine a player at Yale has a good backup plan in terms of employment, but there's nobody at Yale who would be an underrated possible NBA player like Jeremy Lin.
I think the only one that's on Yale right now who has a real chance, maybe there's two. Mekhi Mason, who's their guard. He had a really great game against Baylor, was their star player. And then Justin Sears is a power forward for them. He's got a great back-to-the-basket offense. And these guys could get looks in professional basketball. I don't think that it's likely that they'll play in the NBA for long careers, though.
But you've got three people who do have a chance here. Let's begin with Gary Payton II, who's a guard with the Oregon State Beavers.
Yeah, Gary Payton has an NBA legacy. His dad played in the NBA. His dad played at Oregon State, actually. And Gary, the younger, is a two-time Defensive Player of the Year in the Pac-12. His father was called the Glove because of his prowess. Gary's nickname, reluctantly, is the Mitten, as his taken after his father's name. Huh. He played junior college ball for a couple of years, and his father actually pulled him aside and said, "You've got to get serious about basketball here," and that's when he did. And then he started getting more serious, and he started playing for Oregon State, and now he's top 15 in steal percentage in the country. He averages close to 16 points a game, and I think he has NBA potential for sure.
Beavers are going to advance, it looks like, although you can't predict anything. But why is he overlooked?
I think he's overlooked because primarily he's playing in the Pacific Northwest for a smaller school. Oregon State doesn't get a lot of national media attention. We do tend to focus on the big powerhouses in the Midwest like Kansas and then also the East Coast schools. Villanova gets a lot more attention, right or wrong, than Oregon State does.
Now, Notre Dame could lose to Michigan. They've got a tough contest today. We'll see what happens. Demetrius Jackson is a guard for Notre Dame. He's another one of these overlooked possible stars. What do you think of him?
Yeah, I think he's overlooked because of his height for the most part. The NBA still looks for these prototypical point guards. Even with the success of Stephen Curry, who's a little bit shorter and a little bit lighter than you would normally see from a guard, they still want the 6'5" John Wall type of physique. Demetrius Jackson is only 6'1", but that hasn't stopped him from being extremely successful at Notre Dame. He averages 15.5 points a game, 4.8 assists, and Notre Dame has the number 10 offense in the country.
West Virginia is probably going to advance. Tell me something about Jayshon Page.
There's a lot of interesting things about Jayshon Page, but the most interesting thing is that he's actually the sixth man for West Virginia, so he doesn't even start for the Mountaineers, but he's their leading scorer. You don't see that too often. The reason you see it with West Virginia is because they run this press defense that requires 40 minutes of high-level activity from all their players, so Jayshon comes off the bench and gives them a high-value boost.
Kansas going to take it all?
I have Kansas winning, I have Kansas going to the national championship game, losing to Michigan State.
Wow, that's exciting. Let's talk to you again. David Gardner, college basketball producer with Sports Illustrated. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio, making a picture again.
It was a bilious piece of dirt that made me cry out in pain.
Did you say it was a brilliant piece of work and you'll fly me out to Spain?
I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it.
Friday Movies and our expert on bilious pieces of dirt and everything else that Hollywood produces for us, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hey, Rafer.
Hi,
greetings,
John.
From Boston.
Yeah, how is it out there?
It's lovely. It's absolutely lovely. We got we got three movies to get to today. Miracles from Heaven seems to me like almost a Christian movie of just incredible sentimentality. Let's hear a clip.
This isn't acid reflux.
Her throat shot because she's been throwing up for weeks.
Well, Mom, I'm the doctor, and that's my diagnosis. So if you'll excuse me, I have the patients I need to see.
Excuse me, this is not acid reflux. She's not lactose intolerant. There's something wrong with our little girl.
Mrs. Beam, you need to calm
down.
No,
you calm down.
Jennifer Garner, who was in Dallas, the movie about AIDS with McConaughey, right, is the star here. What's the premise, and how do you like this?
Well, you can hear the faith versus science conflict right there in that little bit that you played. Yeah, she plays Christy Beam. She's the mother of a little girl who's got a severe, life-threatening internal, like an intestinal disorder. That little girl eventually has kind of a freak accident, sees God, wakes up, and is miraculously cured. We've kind of seen this before with Heaven is for Real, a movie from a year or two ago with Greg Kinnear. This one, I would say, is a little bit better, I think, because it sort of takes you into this family struggling with this little girl's illness, which is very heartbreaking. And you really feel for this family. You feel for Jennifer Garner. And I think the message, the sort of miraculous part of it, is tamped down a little bit. It's saved for the end so you don't get too much bludgeoning over the head with this kind of stuff as you do in a lot of faith-based movies. So I would say it's better than most, for sure.
And you like Garner?
I mean, you know, it's the mom with a sick child is, you know, it's the perfect role for Jennifer Garner. I mean, those eyes, you know, she's great. And I would say that her acting chops, I think, kind of lift this film and really help it quite a bit.
Our number two movie is the number three installment of the Divergent series called Allegiant. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Here's a clip.
Sometimes when I look past the wall, I think that I can see something out there. Do you?
No, I don't.
Maybe you need to look harder.
I am looking. I'm just not seeing what you're seeing.
When it's right in front of your face, you will.
So we're really gonna do this?
Yeah.
You like?
Well, I've never been a huge fan of the Divergent series. This has always been kind of the runner-up, I think, to The Hunger Games and even The Maze Runner in my book. And I think the wheels are really coming off of this franchise in this installment. This is one of those finales. It's been split into two. This is the first of the two parts. And I found it just impossible to follow, very, very complicated. It felt like coming in on the 6,000th episode of Young and the Restless and trying to keep track of what's going on. And I've seen all the films. So I thought this was actually the worst of the bunch, and I am not looking forward to the finale, I got to tell you.
Tell me about this movie, Bronze. I've heard nothing about it.
Yeah, this is kind of an under-the-radar entry. It's from Melissa Rauch, who is the star of The Big Bang Theory. She wrote it with her husband, and she plays Hope Ann Gregory. She was a bronze gold medalist in women's gymnastics, kind of a Carrie Strug figure. She did this heroic achievement to win the bronze, comes home and is basically resting on her laurels, but gets a chance to coach a newcomer. And it's a very small-scale, modest film. It doesn't work perfectly, but it has a good heart, and it's very cute and very sweet, and it's got a lot of really good people in the cast. Gary Cole plays her father, who's great. And even though it's a little bit overly crude, the language is a little bit rough, as I think some of these comedies have to be these days, there's something underneath it that I liked about it. I liked the effort that it was putting out.
Breaking Away meets Gymnastics?
I wouldn't go that far, but close. It's trying. It's trying.
Rafer Guzman, have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, John.
Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday. Head over to thetakeaway.org and check out our Take Note section to see the latest election blog from Todd Zwillick and a roundup of the articles and posts we love this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.